Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast on Audio Boom and iTunes. Well, the Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black right here on Long Island is here. All the build-up and hype, all the build-out on the golf course with the double-decker and triple-decker stands and hospitality areas. It's all here. Finally, the much-anticipated international competition is in progress. But leading up, there have been so many stories, so many different angles, and this morning we will discuss some of them. My first guest, Greg Allen, golf correspondent for RTE Radio in Ireland. And Frank Darby. He was the golf coach at St. John's University when U.S. Ryder Cup captain Keegan Bradley played for St. John's. In fact, Coach Darby recruited Keegan Bradley to play for St. John's when no other university gave him a second glance. Bradley's story is quite remarkable, and you'll hear all about it in that segment. Enjoy this Ryder Cup edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, and I am at Bethpage Black for the 2025 Ryder Cup. And it is my pleasure to say hello to Greg Allen, golf correspondent for RTE in Ireland. And Greg, welcome back to Sports Interview.
Yeah, lovely to be back with you, Anne.
It's always great to catch up with you, whether it's at a major championship or a Ryder Cup. How many of these Ryder Cups have you broadcast from now?
This is number 16. Started in 1993, an American victory in the Belfry in Birmingham in England. So got off to a ropey start for Europe, but it's been pretty good since then. 95 Oak Hill was my second Ryder Cup and my first in America, and that obviously was an extraordinary comeback on Sunday by Europe to win. So yeah, that was a pretty good feeling of what it's like for a European team to win on American soil. I think it was only the second time it happened, so it was a special one for me to remember, especially because Philip Walton from Ireland had a very key role. He clinched the winning point on the 18th in a match against Jay Haas. So yeah, got a good Irish story out of a European victory there as well.
16 Ryder Cups, you have me beat by a few. I started in 99 at the Country Club of Brookline, and that was such an incredible American victory, as you know. But let's talk about this Ryder Cup. So much to talk about. And, you know, each of the last five Ryder Cups dating back to 2014 at Glen Eagles have been won by the home side. And obviously in Marco Simone, outside of Rome, Italy, the Europeans, you know, continue to prove that point. What are your thoughts about this week here at Bethpage Black? I mean, Rory McIlroy just felt so confident, and a couple months ago, proclaimed that they will win here.
Well, the bookmakers don't think so, and they normally have a really good insight into the averages. So, yeah, firstly, back to Marco Simeone in Rome, 2023. Europe took a 6.5 to 1.5 lead after the first day, and that was basically almost to within a point, the winning margin at the end. Scottie Scheffler only won 1 point out of four. And look, you know, you can't really operate with a valid hope of winning if your star player doesn't perform. And he didn't perform. He lost that match to Victor Hovland and Ludwig Åberg in, I think it was foursomes on Saturday, by 9-8. So, the differences tend to be very small. Even when it came down to the last four matches on the course in Marco Simeone, this is something which I don't think too many people remember. There was only one hole in it in all four matches on the singles in the final day, and if America had turned around all four of them, it would have been very, very close. It would have been almost tied coming to the end. So even though Europe took a really big lead out of day one, and especially out of the first session, it really was not really a blowout. I think they're all the matches, even 2014, which seemed like a real blowout. If the American team had got off to a strong start in the singles on the final day, which you have to do if you're trailing by any margin, like of 3 or 4 points, that's the key. And you have to have some inspiration to do that. And we saw in 2012 in Medina, an almost impossible comeback was achieved by Europe from 10-4 down with two matches to play on Saturday in the afternoon four balls. So all of these margins seem like they're a bit blowout-ish. But Medina proved that, you know, probably the biggest lead that any team has held over the last six Ryder Cups was the Americans holding a 10-4 lead in Medina, and that was turned over. So why not? Why couldn't it happen again? Very easily. And I think the Ryder Cup, I don't think it needs a close match, because this is a monster of an event now, and it has extraordinary appeal to the public. It transcends golf. It's beyond what you see week in, week out in the PGA Tour. It's beyond the majors in another sort of way, because the majors are obviously geared around an individual's victory. This is tribal. This is two teams going at each other in a manner which no other team event in golf manages, not even the President's Cup. And I know that the President's Cup is a big event for America, but I don't think it matches the Ryder Cup in terms of its intensity. I think it does need a close match. I don't think the appeal will be diminished by a close match, but I think the Ryder Cup, just for the feeling of it being a really, really good event to watch all the way to the last match on Sunday, needs a 14.5, 13.5, or a 15.5, 12.5, or something like that come Sunday.
I definitely think it will be close. I don't know how many people are talking a blowout from one side or the other, but the European team is returning 11 of 12 players from Marco Simone in 2023. The American team has four rookies playing this time around. But if you look at the top-ranked players in the world, the Americans have, what, more? In their, you know, top 12. So, I mean, I just think the teams are so evenly matched this time around.
Yeah, they are. But, I mean, America do have home advantage, distinct home advantage, because it's in New York. It won't be a quiet home advantage. 7 of the top 10 players in the world are American. 3 are European. You know, it's very clear that the player power in terms of the performances over the last 12 months or 2 years are very much geared towards the Americans being the stronger team and with home advantage. So then you come across what is the intangible, which is the emotional element of the Ryder Cup, and the way that it stirs performances out of lesser ranked players. We saw Thomas Peters, I think, do that in 2016, and even in a losing team, I think he was extraordinary. He won four points, I think. So I think the rankings can be nearly thrown out the window to some extent, not completely, obviously, because you have the world's best player and you have 7 of the world's top 10. Europe tend to make up for it, I think, on this occasion with the degree of depth of experience of the team and enough big names as well. And I think as well, Europe are strengthened by the fact that if John Rahm was playing on the PGA Tour, he would be a world's top 10 player. And that would probably be 6-4. And suddenly that doesn't seem such a big skew towards the Americans. Having said that, you know, Bryson DeChambeau's done great things by playing in the Live series. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think the absolute... Once the rankings are fairly close, Europe almost always go in as underdogs. And yet they've won, you know, the majority of the Ryder Cups since Oak Hill that I was referring to earlier in the last 30 years. I think it's 9... for Europe, 5 for America, and 1 halved since 1995. Why is that? Almost every time Europe has gone in as the underdogs. So why is it that, you know, the underdog has won that often? I don't know, because it's an unquantifiable element of the Ryder Cup, where emotion and playing for your team makes a difference more so than any individual golf tournament.
I want to get into that in a second, but going back to the point about the home crowd and the here at Bethpage Black, the People's Course, you know, it's really the first public course in our country that hosted a major championship, 2 U.S. Opens, 1 PGA Championship, a couple PGA Tour events, and you know, a lot of the Europeans, you know, started talking about a while ago about the ruckus crowd and the noise and perhaps the rudeness of the crowd and maybe the hostility. I think that was the word I used. Paul McGinley said hostile crowds in one of his quotes that I read. do they really believe that these crowds are going to be a huge factor in a negative way?
Well, just firstly, to refer to Bethpage Black being the people's course, it may well be the people's course, you know, because it's a public course that is an extremely accessible amount of dollars to play. But the ticket price here is $750. There's not too many of the people's course patrons playing golf each day of the week are probably going to be among those who've spent $750 for a day's entertainment. So, but that doesn't mean that it isn't going to be a massive home advantage, as Europe have a serious home advantage. The impression in Europe is that the home crowd in Europe are tribal and they're very supportive, but a bit more good-humoured and not necessarily... well, you know, if you're on an away team and you're in a sport like golf, which has a respectful sort of element to what, you know, the etiquette of the game and all that, it's a very daunting environment if you're not prepared for the bear pit of a very seriously partisan crowd. But Europe are prepared for it. They've spoken about it. I remember going to Detroit in 2004 for Oakland Hills, and we were... The same narrative was at play, you know, Detroit being Motor City, you know, being a really gritty part of you know, the American Midwest, that it was going to be a really tough crowd for Europe to play in. Europe won 18.5, 9.5, and it was never a contest. One of the reasons was that Europe began to win and win early, and the crowd that was determined to be, you know, very partisan on behalf of the United States, which is the way it should be, I think it's an essential element of the Ryder Cup that the crowd is partisan for home events. I really like that. But once the European points went on the board, the crowd didn't go silent, but they weren't nearly as enthused about their own team as they were a bit sort of bemused as to why their home team was doing so badly. And they didn't turn on the United States in Detroit, but it just wasn't as big a partisan factor for Europe to have to combat. I've noticed the European team doing an awful lot of interview signing this week, autograph signing this week, which is one of the keys, I think, to what they did in Detroit as well on the practice days. They're not trying to win over the crowd. They know they're not going to win over the crowd, but they're just kind of illustrating that we're all flesh and blood, we're all human beings, just treat each other respectfully as we are by signing autographs for American fans. But having said all that, I think it's important that it is tribal because it's what separates it from the President's Cup. The President's Cup can be tribal, but not to the level that the Ryder Cup is, which I've just spoken about. And obviously it's also what separates it from the Masters, the US Open, the PGA, or the British Open, or the Open Championship as we know it. It's what separates it. And it should be tribal. It should be raucous. It just hopefully doesn't go over a particular edge which is acceptable in golf.
But I'm getting the impression through the months that they thought that it's New York, it's going to be so much magnified, the ruckus, crazy, loud, rude crowds. But it's my contention, and I've lived here for so many years, that golf fans here in New York are very knowledgeable, and they respect the game. I just think maybe, like any Ryder Cup, you'll have some people who may be overserved, as they say. At Hazeltine, I know they had to close down some of the bars early. But I just don't think it's going to be anything beyond what previous Ryder Cups have been, whether, you know, it was Hazeltine or Medina here or other American venues. But I want to move on to the controversy over the American players being paid. It just seems to me that, you know, a lot of the European journalists have focused on that questioning to the players this whole week. And $300,000 is going to the charity of the American Players' Choice. An additional $200,000, as you know, is going to that player. So, yes, it's $500,000 per player. But it sounds to me as if a lot of the players, American players, said that all the money that they get would go to charity. But it is a big story because European players aren't getting paid.
Well, I think if it was made clear that all $500,000 was going to charity, there'd be no story. This started in 99. Mark O'Meara made the move, which began to get the PGA of America to feel as though they should pay something for the players to participate in the Ryder Cup, because Mark O'Meara and a few others made the point that maybe that should be the case, that there should be payment. And so that's when they came up with the figure of $200,000. Inflation being what it is, from 1999 to now, it's now at a figure of $500,000. If all of that money is going to charity, there's no story. It's the fact that $200,000 is being given to the players to do what they wish to do, whether that's to give it to charity or to put it in their back pocket. That leaves it open to question as to whether, you know, players playing for in the Ryder Cup should be paid for an event that historically, prior to 2002, there were no payments made. Because the Ryder Cup sort of transcends that element of golf, which is, let's face it, none of these players are going to be poor in their entire lives. What does $200,000 mean to them after the tax man gets whatever it is you got to get at the IRS you have here? So why not just give it all to charity? Then there's no story. So the European team can just say, look, we don't want to be paid. We love the Ryder Cup so much. We just want to play for the European team as we have in the past. And it's kind of like they're all saying we're all well enough paid as it is. However, say 6 million, just say the European team were paid $6 million, which is $500,000 each. And what would they do with it? They'd probably all give it back to the DP World Tour, the European Tour, to make sure that the DP World Tour has a fund to make sure that their events are properly prize moneyed. And I go back to COVID, when the European Tour went through a massively serious crisis because they couldn't hold events because of the lockdowns that were happening all over Europe. So the European Tour dug deep into their finances, and they provided 1 million euro, which is about $1.2 million, to fund prize money for smallish events dotted around Britain. There's about six or seven of them, I think, over a period of a few months. And that's because they had the resources to do it. But they couldn't keep doing it if COVID had gone on for 4 or 5 years. But Europe needed to have their own resource of funding. And so the actual charity, if that's the right way of putting it, it's not a charity, but just for the use of the word, the European players are not seeking money, number one, because they don't feel they need it, and number two, they know the money goes to the DP World Tour, who are well-funded for the tour that they have, which is, in spite of, you know, a lot of people in America thinking that the European Tour isn't even as good as the secondary tour, whatever it's called now, the Web.com or the KF, on the Korn Ferry Tour. The European Tour is probably the second biggest tour in the world. You know, it has a swing at this time of year where you have the Irish Open, which is a $6 million event, Wentworth, which is, I think, an $8 million event or thereabouts, and then it'll go on to the DP World Tour Championship, which is a $10 million or $9 million event. So it does have big events on its roster, and it's important that the European Tour has the funding to you know, prop up the events which are weaker on its roster. So basically the European Tour is like the place where the European players know that the money that the Ryder Cup makes for Europe goes to the European Tour, or the DP World Tour as it's called. And that's, it's not a charity, but that's their sort of charity. So they don't even think that it's necessary to be paid, because the money is going towards, like, a lot of the players on the European Tour are now PGA Tour players, but they grew up on the European Tour and they feel that they actually owe something back to their tour, and this is their way of doing it. So it's not even a question, and certainly at this point in the proceedings, it's not even a question in the European team to get paid.
I love that mentality, because I just think it is a PR nightmare for the Americans. And I just don't think they're making so much money as it is on the PGA Tour now with these signature events. And even before the signature events and the $20 million tournament payouts, it was just, they're just making, it's become all about money. And it just seems to me that it's too much about money. And the Ryder Cup should not be about money. In fact, I recall Rory McIlroy saying that he would pay to play on the Ryder Cup team. And Luke Donald said, in quotes, "This is not a week to get paid. We have such a strong purpose in this team and what we play for. And to be honest, we," as you were saying, he says, "we reinvest some of that money back into the experiences of these guys." And You know, I just think, I also read where Luke Donald gave Team Europe the option to get paid, and it was universally rejected. So I think it's really become a very negative PR situation for the American team.
Well, I won't say anything about that, because you've made that point. But I will go to say one thing, that as soon as McIlroy said that thing about that he would pay to play in the European team, he was making sort of a point. He wasn't, he wasn't going to ever physically pay to play in the European team, but he was trying to use it as a way of making a point. And I saw this retort from Mark O'Meara, oh yeah, well, he would say that because he's got a private jet. It's got nothing to do with it. It was a terrible retort. It wasn't like, it didn't mean anything. Rory was just saying, look, the point is that we would pay to play in it on the European team, even though they're never going to have to do it. But he was just trying to make a point as a counterpoint to the Americans seeking to be paid. And the Americans can seek to be paid all they want, because it's a different culture. You have a different way of looking at money than we have in Europe. It's not necessarily a reason to live in Europe, you know, how much money you make, although many people are very, very, obviously, in European golf, very, very well off. But it just doesn't seem to be as big a point for European players as it is for the American team, obviously. And it goes back to Mark O'Meara, 25 years ago, saying, look, we should be paid, even if it is for charity, we should be paid something to play to play for the American, the Ryder Cup. And in that period of more than 20 years, it's never been an issue for Europe to ask to be paid. It never crossed their mind. And yet it came up at the last Ryder Cup with Pat's hat, Pat Cantlay and the hat, whatever it was. Look, I'm not going to let anybody other than you interpret what that Pat's hat thing was about. But anyway.
We don't know either.
But whether it was a protest or not against not being paid, who cares, to be honest? Because it's moved on. It's like everything in Ryder Cup week. There's always a reason to talk about something that might sort of stir a bit of enmity between the teams, even though it's not real enmity. But, these preview days are long enough, so we have to find a way of finding a story to make an angle that might work, just to get the teams to talk.
Absolutely. And I must say that, the journalists from your side are really making that a big story. But
I don't think so. It is there. It's a story. Journalists respond to something that's been done. And I think the weakness is the fact that the 500,000 includes 200,000 for the players to put in their back pocket. I mean, if it was a payment of $1 million and it all went to charity, I think the Europeans would be clapping, and everybody would be saying, well done, great idea. But just make it all charity. I mean, one event in 2 years, is it possible that you could just play for your country?
Right. I am totally... I agree with that, but it is a big story, and I think it is checkpoint for the Europeans, because they don't get paid, and I don't think any of these players should get paid when you're representing your country like this. Let's move on to the European team. Roy McIlroy, Robert McIntyre, Tommy Fleetwood, Justin Rose, Rasmus Højgaard, Tyrell Hatton, and the captain's picks, Shane Lowry, Sepp Straka, Ludvig Åberg, Victor Hovland, Matt Fitzpatrick, and John Rahm. I want to talk about Rory McIlroy, Greg. Rory, what would winning an away Ryder Cup mean to Rory McIlroy, particularly this season when he won the Masters, capturing the career Grand Slam, and, which was to him the ultimate, a dream come true?
I think there are two... things in Rory's year since he won the Masters, and obviously we saw that almost, I wouldn't say crisis of motivation that he felt in the weeks after the Masters, when he started to think, what do I practice for now, why do I slave for 4 hours in the practice ground hitting two irons, beautifully, or whatever it is that he was doing on the practice ground. Why does he do it? Because up to the Masters he knew why he was doing it. It was to complete the career Grand Slam and to win the Masters. And to, finally put, close the book on his 2011 experience at the Masters when he lost a four-shot lead in the final round. So he went through, a fairly short but very sharp, you could see it in his demeanour, motivation deficit. But there was two things in his mind. Number one was the Open in Portrush, the British Open in Portrush, his home on the island of Ireland, in Northern Ireland. It was a huge thing for him. And he got up for that sufficiently to finish in a seventh place, which was a good sort of performance, and the crowd had plenty to cheer for, not just for the winner, but also in the way that McIlroy showed up as he did. And the other one was the Ryder Cup, because winning in a Ryder Cup on away soil is something that means a huge amount. I'm sure it means a lot to the Americans, but it means a huge amount to Europe to win in away soil. And he saw that as the other peak in his year to get motivated for. And as the year unfolded and he, you know, rose out of his motivation issues, it became even more important. And here we are. I think you don't get much more motivated for anything in golf other than winning the possibility of winning an away Ryder Cup, because it is huge. I mean, Medina in 2012, the manner in which it happened, of course, made it even bigger, because obviously Europe came from so far back, 10-4 down at one point, 10-6 down going into the singles. And it wasn't just called the Miracle of Medina for no reason, because Europe were inspired by the memory of Seve, because the captain was Jose Maria Olazabal, who had formed those fantastic partnerships with Seve going back to 1987. And so there was that emotional connection to the prospect of winning on away soil, which Seve had been part of in 1987, not just part of, but a key part of. He clinched, he clinched the winning point in 1987 after Eamon Darcy had clinched the point that retained the Ryder Cup. So all of that feeds into this extraordinary thing that until Europe became Europe in the Ryder Cup in 1979, the matches were dying, you know, because the American team were beating the Britain and Ireland team, which was the case until 1977, by large margins, with the exception of 1957 in Lindrick in Yorkshire, where it was a drawn match. But ritually, it was becoming too one-sided. And so when Europe came together in 1979, they lost badly on American soil in 79. They lost even worse, I think, it was Walton Heath in 1981, but then came Palm Beach Gardens in 1983, and Europe only lost 14.5, 13.5. Lanny Watkins had to hit it to a foot from the hole on the 18th for America to get across the line for the victory. And since then, the Ryder Cup has been, you know, what it is. I've almost forgotten the point that you were making at the start.
Rory McIlroy.
Yeah. So going back to all of that, the win on away soil is so precious because it has been relatively so rare, and it's one of the big things in golf to do so, especially I think for Europe to win on American soil, because America have the dominance in the world rankings in terms of the player power.
Is it true, and they've been saying this for years, that the European team, it's so obvious to me that they have more camaraderie, they're just better as a unit, that they hang out together? I know they came in over a week ago and they practiced here at Bethpage Black Tuesday, Wednesday. Then a couple of them went out to the east end of Long Island, you know, my neck of town and my neck of the woods. And they played Sabonic and they played Shinnecock and they played Fireside. They just had a great time. The camaraderie is obvious. Is it still true, do you think, that they totally outshine the American team with that camaraderie and with that team aspect?
I don't think it's fair to say that the American team don't have a camaraderie at the level of Europe. I just think it's a different camaraderie. We are very different cultures. We speak the same language, but you know, it's really clear. Like I'm Irish and I've got Celtic blood, but my relationship with, say, the Latin countries of Europe would be very strong in terms of how we express ourselves. I absolutely really enjoy the company of anybody from Scandinavia. They're so practical, they're so focused, but they're also really well-rounded, you know, human beings. And I just love the culture of France in particular. I speak reasonably good French. So Europe might seem like a bunch of different countries from the American perspective, but really it's an awful lot of small countries in a relatively small, you know, distance. There's virtually no country in Western Europe I can't fly to in 2 hours. So what's a 2-hour flight? Florida to New York, or, you know, and yet across that 2 hours, I will fly across 6 or 7 different countries with very different cultures. And yet, there is a bond of European people, helped, of course, by the EU, the formation of the EU in 1972. which makes us feel to some degree European, but also not a country. But we're a very united continent, and every country has its own individual issues with other countries. But I think, you know, you'll find the same difference between California and Oklahoma, you know what I mean? So, but there is something about the Ryder Cup which has made it easy for players to come together during Ryder Cup week. And I go back to Tony Jacklin. When he took over the European team in 1983, he was transformative in the manner in which he looked at Europe and brought the team together. And Seve, we go back to Seve the whole time. Nobody would glue the team together more than Seve, because Seve would come into the team room in the 1980s as one of the biggest stars, arguably, in European sport. He certainly was one of the biggest stars in European sport, whether it's global sport or not. And he would sprinkle his star power on all those young players. Paul Way, for example, back in 1983, he had to chaperone Paul Way, because Paul was a good player but not a great player. And Paul was sort of starstruck by Seve. But that simple element of a Spaniard and an Englishman bonding together in a match together, not speaking the same language, although Seve spoke good English, but at the same time, it's not his native language. And yet it was seamless. And I think the legacy began with the way that Seve, with his huge personality, brought it into the team room in Europe and made everybody feel like they were one. It's the old thing now that's become what Rory calls now, or what everybody else in Europe calls now, you leave your ego at the door and you go in the door. And I think Europe do that particularly successfully. Up to you to decide whether America do it as successfully. I'll let you comment on that. But Europe do it seamlessly. That's for some reason. And they get on well. Like, you know, the European players who play together on the PGA Tour, they're a band of brothers, I think, as well. So, and because they're all away from home, or certainly away from their native country, a lot of them live in America now. But there's a certain camaraderie and bonding between them, even in the PGA Tour week-to-week rota.
I wanted to ask you about Jon Rahm. To your point, Jon Rahm, Spaniard, now live golfer. The European Ryder Cup team has taken him in like he's, you know, obviously one of them. But is there a division there? I mean, obviously, Rory was so much opposed to live golf and was very outspoken about it, you know, in the last couple of years. But how do they disregard the live golf aspect? And obviously, Rahm's such a great player. They won him on the team. He was a captain's pick by Luke Donald. But what's the attitude about Jon Rahm?
I think it's back to what it was in 2023 when he was a PGA Tour player. I think there was an initial disappointment that a player of the size and reputation of Jon Rahm went to the LIV series, you know, certainly from the perspective of the players who play on the PGA Tour on the European team. But, you know, I don't think it's as big a factor now. Time heals a lot of wounds, and that was December of 23. So we're now, a year and 8 months on, or a year and 10 months on from that. And Jon Rahm is still Jon Rahm. I think Jon Rahm hasn't ever kind of, you know, bolted the door behind him and locked it, and you know, told his European players, "You've all made a big mistake here." You know, not like some players who went to LIV and did exactly that.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Greg Allen of RTE Radio. I always enjoy your insight, and let's have a great time here at the Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black.
And let the best men win, whoever they are.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ann.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann McGorry, and it is my pleasure to say hello to longtime friend and colleague Frank Darby, who coached golf at St. John's University for 23 years. Keegan Bradley, the captain of the U.S. Ryder Cup team, was one of his star players. Frank, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Hey, it's an honor to be on Sports Interview. I mean, I'm looking at all the people that you've done through the years, Stallone, Muhammad Ali. Boy, I'm thrilled to be a part of this.
Well, it's always fun to go on your show, too, on course, on Sirius XM, PGA Tour Radio, and you and Brian do such a great job. And here we are at the 2025 Ryder Cup, Bethpage Black. I mean, it doesn't get better than this, right, when you're talking about a Ryder Cup in our country?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You know, like, and I'm friendly with the whole staff here at Bethpage and Andy Wilson, the director of agronomy, and he's like, we had him on our show the other day, and he's like, I've been waiting for this thing for 13 years. You know, that's when they made the announcement, and it's finally here as well, and I'll tell you what, it's pretty smooth out here. Everything has been, you know, the PGA of America, who I've been a member of the PGA for 42 years, they do a great job on just planning and putting on events.
It's unbelievable. The build-out has been spectacular. I know they started way in mid-May, but when I first arrived here and saw, you know, the stands overlooking the first tee box and the 18th green, I just can't believe what a great job they've done. And throughout the entire golf course, all the hospitality areas, I mean, what great planning and what a great build out.
Well, you know, like Jeff Poplawski, who is my co-host on the Road to the Ryder Cup podcast we're doing. So a U.S. Open is 600,000 square feet usually. The Ryder Cup, 1.6 million square feet. Unbelievable. And it's enormous. But you know what, Ann? You being a New Yorker, me being a New Yorker, we like enormity.
We like enormity, and let's talk about that. You know, just for the record, I'm originally from Ohio, so I am a Midwesterner. But I'm a New Yorker because I came here right out of college, Frank, and never left. I love New York. I'm on the number one sports radio station in New York, WFAN, and you know, I'm very proud of being a New Yorker now. I have a house on Long Island. I lived in the city for 25 years, and it just kind of irks me when I hear so much attention about how people think, particularly the European side, that the New York crowds are going to be rude and ruckus and just too crazy, and because all Ryder Cups have that. But it seems like there's kind of pointing out New York fans as, you know, going to be over the top, and I can't see that.
Yeah, I think we get a bad rap right here. Yes, we're kind of like Keegan. We're really passionate. You know, we're fiery. We're fighters, you know. And, you know, and it's only been reinforced by what we've gone through here, especially with 9/11. So, I mean, you know, maybe, you know, they always say that Keegan's got a little chip on his shoulders. Well, I think you and I do, too.
Well, that's right. We do. And you know what? I lived through 9/11. You lived through 9/11. I lived in the city. I remember the aftermath of 9/11 going in. I was on Long Island, actually, when it happened. But about a couple of days later, I went back to my apartment in the city. I felt the, you know, the sadness, and it was like a morgue, and, you know, pictures of missing photos on every door, and the fire stations with candles mourning all the firefighters they lost. So I lived through that, and I think you're right. I think, you know, the unity that New Yorkers showed after 9/11 and that passion for, you know, sport and for golf is going to really come out, and I think maybe they should look at that more than they should look at fans being rude here.
Yeah, you know, I still think, I'm sure you're going to agree with me, I still think one of the greatest moments was when George Bush threw out that first ball at Yankee Stadium. I mean, he was pissed, you know, and you could just see it, and, you know, he got out there, give me that ball, just threw a strike, let me get out of here, I got things to do. It was really cool to watch that.
Right, and Giuliani did such a great job as mayor to get the city back. But anyway, so fast forward, 2025, Keegan Bradley. You recruited him, and I heard a piece that was done where his father said that no other colleges really came a calling, that his father put like a video tape together with Keegan's swing, showing Keegan's swing, and his father, you know, is a PGA pro. And when did you see that, and what made you call Keegan Bradley?
Well, a really good friend of mine, Dave Adamanis, who runs this tour up there called the United States Challenge Cup Tour, based out of Boston. Keegan played at a place called Hopkinton High School. They won the state team championship. He played with a guy named John Curran, who was on tour for a couple of years. He's his best friend. And a girl named Kim Donovan, who played at Duke. And Keegan upset them. He was the number three player. He upset them in the states and won the individual title. So Dave, and then John Curran immediately signed with Vanderbilt. Kim signed with Duke. So Keegan was kind of sitting out there, and it wasn't long. I got a phone call from Dave Adamanis, and he said, do you have any interest in a kid named Keegan Bradley? I'm like, Bradley, all right. Any relation to Pat? He's like, yes, that's his aunt. I'm like, okay, when should I drive up? And he goes, don't worry, they'll get back to you. And then day and a half later, they came down to Fairfield. They drove down, Mark and Keegan, and I signed them on the spot. Because it was just a matter of, luckily, he didn't play a lot of AJGA events. He didn't have national exposure like John and Kim did. And I just knew the kid. You could just tell by looking at him. He was tall already. He just had that look about him like, you know, he's been battling things and he wanted to. He looked like a battler. He looked like an Irish fighter, you know, to me. And I'm like, ooh, I think I want a kid like this. And, you know, so he ended up coming to me and we had a absolute four great years.
I love that. And he's, you know, not from a privileged background. And he's, you know, from a blue-collar family, right? Well, his father was PJ Pro. But, you know, he didn't grow up in the country club kind of lifestyle like so many of these successful golfers do. And you know, it's so great that you gave him the opportunity and that you saw something in him that nobody else saw on the college level.
Yeah, I can still see it now. You know, I must have given 50 of these types of talks about Keegan Bradley. And he's easy to talk about because, you know, he's magnetic. You know, he walks into a room and people look at him. I mean, they know he's a fighter. He just loves challenges. Keep giving him challenges. When people stop giving him challenges, I'm not going to hang around him because he just loves. Ooh, you can see him filing things in his back of his mind, and he doesn't forget that stuff. And you know, he's been through a lot, but we all have too. You know, but he's overcome it and. You know, I think that the one thing that I love talking about with him is that my closer was Coach Lou Conaseca. So I made sure that Conaseca saw him when he came down to St. John's. And, you know, and Conaseca had always told me, hey, make sure you love your players and make sure you show them how much you care. And, you know, like I said, I think a lot of people, especially a lot of men, are nervous to say, hey, I love you. No, I love you because of the things you do and the way you do it. And Keegan, hopefully, kind of learned that from me because they knew how much I cared about all those guys on all those teams.
Right, well, you both are very passionate. You're both really good Irish lads you are. So how was the team when Keegan played, and what was that experience like coaching him?
Well, the first year, we were trying to still put a couple of teams together, a couple of players onto the team. And the best way to do it was I let Keegan give me a couple of names as well from Boston. And I always made a really good living on, I always recruited the kids, the really good players that wanted to go south from here. But I always make sure I preface it by saying, when you're ready to come back, if you are, I'm here. I got money. I got a scholarship. So I got three or four kids that came back immediately from Old Dominion, another kid from, where else? Georgia Tech and different places. And we put together a team, and, you know, Keegan won 9 times. We made it to the NCAAs 3 of the 4 years. And we had a lot of fun. You know, we did a ton of traveling, playing a national schedule. And, you know, the big thing every day was, where were we going to eat at night? We like to eat at good places. So went to a lot of steak places, and we had fun.
I love that. And tell me about then the relationship with Beth Page Black. Is this where St. John's played?
We never played here. We had access to every private club in the area. I was a head professional at a club, so I grew up with a lot of them. I would do their member guest scoreboards. I'm a scoreboard keeper. I'd waive my fee, and then they'd say, anytime you want to bring your guys out, give me a call. So I only had 6 guys on the team. So it wasn't like now where they got these 12 kids and all of a sudden you call on the club. It's very hard. I could sneak 2 threesomes out. And what happened was as we went, and, you know, Keegan was the leader, definitely the leader. Hey, make certain you say hi to the golf pro, the greens chairman, the superintendent. We'll take them to basketball games at the Garden. And we really cultivated that relationship. And then all of a sudden we didn't even have to call. North Shore kind of adopted this, North Shore Country Club, and so did Wheatley Hills. So, you know, it's just being nice to people. And I think Keegan has seen that, at least hopefully through me, really kind of paid off.
But yet Keegan said he played at Bethpage Black a lot.
Well, what happened was Keegan always gave me the challenge because once, and you know it being a member of the club in the Hamptons, once like November comes, they start shutting the golf courses down. They go to temporary greens because of the frost and hot and cold, and then the golf courses get bad, get hurt for the spring. So Keegan was always looking for a place to play, and Craig Currier was still my best friend. He was the superintendent here. He used to come to basketball games, and he'd say, "Hey, if you guys want to come out and play the short course, be my guest." So that means they would park their cars in maintenance, stay on that side of the road, and play 3 to 14 a couple of times. And nobody ever saw him. And the secret got out. Keegan kind of gave the secret out, kind of threw Craig and I under the bus one time at the FedEx Cup when somebody from the media asked him, "How many times have you played Bethpage Black?" And he said, "About 100. And then he went through the story, and, well, we got a little bit of abuse, but it was definitely worth it. Listen, you know it. If you grow up playing in golf, especially when you're a junior, and you've never been kicked off a private club, you're not a golfer.
Yeah, but Bethpage Black, I mean, not really private, right? It's public. But, you know, I used to have guys, when I did the overnight show, "Hey, LaGuardia, what's the story?" They'd be sleeping in their cars, and they would call my show and come on live, and we'd talk sports. They had nothing else to do but to call and talk to me on FAN. But he did say how sometimes he was forbidden to cross the road here. Because, you know, they didn't want it,
yeah, they didn't want anybody to be seen.
But he did a few times, and when you found out, you were not happy.
Well, I kind of remember the story, but I think that's the worst thing. I don't ever remember telling them not to cross the road. I'm sure Craig told them. You know, you tell 18 to 20-year-old kids, don't do this, don't do that, they're going to kind of experiment. They're going to go to the limit on where they can go. And I guess they got caught. And, I guess I was mad. I don't ever remember getting mad at Keegan Bradley my entire life, let alone 4 years at St. John's, because, you know, I mean, he was just great to be around.
And going back to 9/11, the story I heard about he and his sister raising money at a local event, you know, in his hometown, and then driving down to Manhattan and donating it to a firehouse, it's just endearing.
Yeah, Chris Mascali, that was yesterday, and I know Chris. I've met him a couple of times, and that was really cool what Keegan did. And, you know, having the whole USA team out there 7 o'clock in the morning listening to Chris's story, I think those are the kind of moments that kind of make you feel grateful for where you are.
So what was your reaction when you first found out that Keegan Bradley would be the U.S. Ryder Cup captain?
Yeah, I was, you know, not surprised. I mean, he checks all the boxes. You know, I thought it might be 10 years down the line. But you know what? I mean, I know Seth Waugh pretty good, and you could just see where he probably came from. I guess they knew that Phil wasn't going to be involved with him going to live. Tiger was too busy. Why not? Why not have somebody that's, you know, thinking outside the box, and maybe we need a little bit of a change. And I tell you what, I think we're going to really see what this hiring of Keegan Bradley to be the Ryder Cup captain is going to pay off in 10 years. You know, I mean, hopefully we're going to see it on Sunday, and then hopefully hopefully all of a sudden they do a Luke Donald and let him go to Ireland, because we need an Irish guy to take that team to Ireland. And then I think what's going to happen is you're going to see some people that are going to be in the line, like he's got great vice captains right here. One guy that I think fits the mold of a future captain is Webb Simpson. That he's, you know, so, you know, I think that the we're not going to go with the guys that are not playing anymore. That's why Keegan is so good, because he sees these guys up and close and personal playing with them.
Absolutely. And were you surprised, because I know you wanted him to play, you wanted Keegan Bradley to pick himself to be, you know, one of the six captains' picks. Were you surprised that he did not pick himself to play?
Well, yeah, I kind of was kind of more guilty of just, I wanted him to hit the first tee shot off the first hole. You know, but for the most part, I mean, I guess after he rationalized it and, you know, told us what his thoughts were, I think that he's done the right thing. You know, maybe the next time after he wins this week, hopefully they'll come out and say, "Keegan, why don't we just make you the player captain right now for the next one, and you only get 5 picks?" You know, why not? Because he's been through it. You know, like they've asked Luke Donald that a couple times. You know, could you do it? He's like, probably not, but at least he's got the experience of going through this for the last 2 years, and it takes up your whole life.
It really takes up your whole life. That's why to even entertain it. I was impressed that, you know, but Keegan has that passion and wanted to play so bad. And he was asked about, does he kind of regret the fact that he didn't pick himself earlier in the Ryder Cup week? And he goes, I think about it every second. Yeah. I really, you know, do feel or think that I, you know, would love to be out there.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like I said, I think I was just being a little selfish. But you know what? He's doing a great job right there. You can tell he's relaxed. He's having fun. And I think that there's an utmost – I mean, you and I were in the interview yesterday. He was smiling an awful lot. And, you know, I think these guys are having fun with him.
You know, I have to say, Frank, I'm impressed with their media skills, not just Captain Keegan Bradley, but the entire team, obviously being pressed on, you know, getting paid, that issue, and the way they're handling, you know, a lot of the questions. They seem so professional, and I know Keegan admitted at one point that he actually trained on a teleprompter because for the opening ceremonies, he has to read off his teleprompter, and he was really nervous about that. So I'm wondering if he was more nervous about reading off a teleprompter than perhaps, you know, captaining this U.S. Ryder Cup team.
Yeah, I heard him say that yesterday. He's probably, if I know Keegan, he's probably on the teleprompter right now. But I think those guys, hey, yeah, I mean, think about the first time you did a show. Same with me. You know, now all of a sudden, you know, you just get used to it because, first of all, I think all those guys ask everybody the same question anyway. So they can kind of rehearse it a little bit. And like I said, it was fun sitting in there yesterday, you know, listening to, you know, them talk about a whole lot of different varied questions that were answered. Yeah.
What will being at the opening ceremony, being one of the guests, what will that mean to you?
Yeah, well, hey, listen, I always thought I was kind of somewhat part of the family. You know, his mom, Kay, is really, really special to me because I would go up to Boston and speak to a lot of the juniors up there. And one time I called Kay up and I said, Kay, I don't have a guest with me. Can you come down and just hang with me? And so we both got up on the stage, and all I did was talk for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then all the hands started going up. And Kay and I were up there for a good 45 minutes asking questions. So the reason why we're really close with Kay, too, is because she traveled with us. She went to all of Keegan's events. So she got to see him. She was part of the team, as I'm really honored to be a part of their team as well.
Frank Darby, PGA professional, talk show host, and most importantly this week at the Ryder Cup, Keegan Bradley's friend and former coach. Thanks so much for being on Sports Interview.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ann.
My thanks to Greg Allen of RTE Radio, to Frank Darby, and to Mike Goodsell in production. I always like to end the show with a quote. So let me end this Ryder Cup show with a quote from the great Seve Ballesteros, the most inspiring Ryder Cup player of all time. He compiled a career record of 20 wins, 12 losses, and 5 ties over 8 Ryder Cup appearances, scoring 22.5 points for the European team in total, and playing a pivotal role in the resurgence of European dominance in the competition from 1979 to 1995. Seve always used to say, in quotes, life is like sport. You have to fight every day, and the key is to never give up. He also said, in quotes, confidence comes by practice. It doesn't happen overnight. Nothing happens without hard work. Have a great week. Be kind. Be safe. And I look forward to visiting with you next time right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.